Okay, now I am once again, jeez, putting the keyboard as far away from my sightless hands as I can here. This is the Mideast Migraines Program weekend edition for Saturday, September 3, 2016. This program, provided the recording of it survives my erstwhile clumsiness, will be archived at another website, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, ALL.net. Go to radioforall.net. Type in Mideast Migraines in the search box, and you'll get my recently recorded programs. Or perhaps not so recent. I am very slowly in the process of uploading them. So far, I have roughly pretty much the first three chapters and the introduction of the book uploaded to radioforall.net. So those are available for Fatal Embrace up through chapter three, almost the end of three. It's happening, folks. It's taking its sweet time. All right, I'm taking my sweet time. My name is Lawrence Rentoul, your friendly local Palestinian American, who unabashedly, unashamedly is providing a biased, very subjective look at the Palestinian narrative about what has been going on since about 120 odd years ago in Palestine and the portion of it that later became officially known as Israel, but particularly since 1948, the year of the modern 20th century state of Israel's birth, 1948. That's why I'm here. I make no qualms about it. If you wanted to dismiss it as pure propaganda, fine, but I still would ask you to listen to the entire two-hour show before your mind settles too comfortably on that description of what I'm doing. This program engages in absolutely no anti-Semitism, no form of Jew-hating, or I'm not trying to propagate hatred of the Jewish religion or Jewish people or individuals. That would be totally counterproductive to what I'm trying to do. In criticizing Israel, its policies, its government, its military, and in criticizing the underpinning Zionist philosophy, which is the real reason for the troubles, central troubles in the Middle East to begin with, I separate that entirely from any judgment of the Jews, per se. Anti-Zionism is not the same as anti-Semitism. Anyone who wants you to believe that it is that that's a gimmick which is used for the purpose of trying to dismiss Israel's critics as all a bunch of Jew-hating bastards. So don't believe a word of that. I'm actually not inclined to say don't believe or don't listen to. I never want to say don't listen to such and such, because ultimately the answer to the troubles there has to do with getting people to be willing to listen to the other side and decide for yourself if you want to continue listening to them, if it's worthwhile. But we do have to listen to each other in order to straighten out this damn mess over there, which is going on 70 years old now. Okay. And again, my apologies for such a late start to the show and for messing things up in the first recording. Okay. One more shot at this. Yeah, I was talking about how Mark Braverman, the author of Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, is extremely philosophical here. He's putting forth many ideas to, for one thing, ultimately meld the most basic underpinnings of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, for that matter, into one consistent philosophy. He's not a pie-in-the-sky Unitarian individual. Again, he is an American Jew who resides on the East Coast of the United States. Still considers himself a good Jew, good Jewish man. In other words, he's not a self-hating Jew. That's another phrase that people resort to when they just don't want to listen to criticism of Israel. The thing is, and my mind is going off on tangents again. Did I mention I'm 63 years old? And to get to the point where we can talk about sort of melding of the underpinnings of the religious faiths, and this is not a new idea. After all, there are definite traditions and principles that go back to something of a common history of all three major Western, as it were, religions: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, in that historical order. As Menachem Begin insisted on putting it, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But in order to get to that point, what each religion needs to do is to sort of reawaken itself and appreciate these those common underpinnings and traditions and principles. So he's gone into great lengths about that. And to be perfectly honest, this is not easy stuff to listen to because it's very heady. He doesn't use a whole lot of big words, but he does. Mr. Braverman gets into a frame of mind and tries to get his readers into a frame of mind that sort of takes it. Sort of this, the author assumes a degree of understanding of these religious faiths, but he does his best to flesh some of this stuff out for those who may no longer be, or might not be to begin with, a practicing Jew, Christian, or Muslim. Okay, now, just in trying to describe this, I'm sounding an awful lot like the man himself. A lot of this, frankly, is boring and dry, but I will complete the book in the coming months, and even if you don't want to exhaust yourself, and if you don't want to exhaust your current mental state by trying to sew all this together, at least hang in there and try to relate to some of the stuff that I am talking to you about. Okay, don't act like there's going to be a final exam or a pop quiz at any time. So don't strain yourself to try to memorizing all of this. I just like you to pick up things that you can use in understanding the Middle Eastern debacle, as Braverman describes it, and take it from there, okay? And when this book is done in 2 or 3 or 4 months, however longer it takes, I promise you I will endeavor to find material that is more approachable, easier to listen to, and for that matter, easier for me to read. Okay. As I said, I began part two of the three-part book, was it last Saturday, I think, or the Saturday before? I think it was last Saturday. And as Braverman explains here in the end of the introduction about this book, in part two, we undertake a consideration of Christianity's post-World War II project to atone for anti-Semitism. Chapters 5 and 6 are a review of the effort by Christians to reverse the theology responsible for two millennia of Western anti-Semitism. We'll pay, up until World War II, pretty much. We'll pay particular attention, he says, to the implications of this project for Christian attitudes toward modern political Zionism. Okay, let's get rolling here. We are in the middle of chapter 3, beginning of part 2. Slight overlap here. I will begin. Something seems really loud to me. I've complained about the poor quality of here. That'll help the modulation a little bit. It's still kind of screaming into my ears here. I think Hello. Okay, well, that's better. Problem was, I actually didn't have it turned up high enough so that I knew. Okay, I know you can hear me, folks. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines. I'm your host, Renta Wheel. Reading from Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, subsection of Chapter 3, elevating, quote, God's beloved child. Slight rehash, I believe, from last week. The problem with this formulation is that Sulan, a man that the author has spoken of much up to this point, in his effort to forge a theological bond between the two faiths, has embraced what is an exceptionalist and ultimately triumphalist Jewish position. Visegrod is an Orthodox rabbi who believes that the election of the Jews, that's the election of the Jews, is the core of Jewish identity. Visegrod writes, quote, "The foundation of Judaism is the family identity of the Jewish people as the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Sounds kind of like Sunday school. I'm sure a lot mentioning those old names, Abraham, Isaac, etc. Continuing, whatever else is added to this must be seen as growing out of and related to the basic identity of the Jewish people as the seed of Abraham, elected by God through descent from Abraham, close quote, from Visegrod, 1989. And he says this, Israel is the carnal anchor that God has sunk into the soil of creation, from the same work. In a recent paper discussing Visegrod's work, Solon, apparently aware of the exceptionalist tone of this and similar statements establishing the primacy of Judaism in the Jewish people, claims that, quote, God did not choose Israel because it was superior to other peoples. I'll say it again. He claims that God did not choose Israel because it was superior to other peoples. 2004. Yet in the same paper, Solon speaks again and again of God's special love for Israel and of Israel's election by God for a special role in history. Indeed, the notion of superiority is hard to separate from that of election. Boom! My folded American flag here to rest the book on because it's not a hardback. I don't want to completely wreck the edges of the binding. If I can only keep away from the keyboard. I don't want to mess things up. Where was I? Yet in the same paper, Solon speaks again and again of God's special love for Israel and of Israel's election by God for a special role in history. Indeed, the notion of superiority is hard to separate from that of election. If being elected for a special role in fulfilling God's plan for his creation does not confer special status, what else could possibly be required? It is one step from Jewish specialness to Jewish superiority. If not in Solon's mind, then certainly one must imagine in the minds of most Christians, one step from Jewish specialness to Jewish superiority, and most certainly in the attitudes of many Jews. Consider this quote from Visegrod further on in Solon's 2004 paper. Here, Solon describes Visegrod's concept of the special nature of God's relationship with the Jewish people. It is the basis for God's election of Israel and his persistent fidelity to the Jews despite their rebelliousness. Quote, "For this reason, God's love is not undifferentiated, having the same quality toward all God's children. Precisely because God is so deeply concerned with human creation, God loves it with a differentiated love. And it comes about that there are those whom God loves especially, with whom one can only say God has fallen in love," close quote, 2004, from a work of his in 2004. to this Jewish reader, this is the author speaking, Mark Braverman, to this Jewish reader, if this is Christianity, then it is a faith that has swallowed an extremely problematic concept. Solon's arguments endorse an outright Jewish triumphalism. What we have here is actually a kind of, in italics here, reverse supersessionism, a backwards subsuming of Christianity into the original faith. I told you this guy was heady, folks, but I think he knows what he's talking about. Continuing, to accept this is to invite the prospect not of a continuity of shared faith, but a concept in which all religions are worshiping God on the foundation established by God through his covenant with Israel. Israel's on top. Perhaps sensing the powerful implications of this theory, Solon, quoting Visegrad, notes that this specialness does not come without responsibility. Quote, Israel tends to forget that its election is for service, that it is a sign of the infinite and unwarranted gift of God, rather than any inherent superiority of the people. 2004. Author says, I know this argument. It is well known to any Jew who has undergone religious education, and then all this in italics. We are the chosen people, but this status carries special responsibilities. But far from mitigating the sense of specialness, doesn't this argument really serve to reinforce and strengthen it? What is usually brought into, that's funny, what is usually brought into this discussion is the often quoted light to the nations, or light unto the nations, passage from Isaiah chapter 49. From election to special love, to special responsibilities, to bring God's message to the world, God's election of Israel leads to Jewish exceptionalism and ultimately to triumphalism. A theology that attempts to correct for Christian supersessionism by preserving or incorporating God's election of Israel ultimately replaces Christian supersessionism with Jewish exceptionalism. And if Christian triumphalism, as expressed in supersessionalism, led to the ovens of Auschwitz, if it did lead to the... I'll start the sentence again. And if triumphalism, as expressed in supersessionism, led to the ovens of Auschwitz, then Jewish triumphalism, as expressed in political Zionism, has led to the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Gonna grab a little cold drink here. On this program, I tend to go back and forth between the hot coffee or tea and the cold ice cube filled drinks. Still trying to decide which works better for my throat. Where was I? Okay, the ethnic cleansing in Palestine. If, as Solon proposes, the problem with the church is that it, quote, has failed to understand itself in light of God's fidelity to the people Israel, 1996, I submit that we need to find another solution. It will be a solution that, if it does hark back to that original covenant, does so in a fashion that looks critically at the implications of that covenant and searchingly at the dynamics of the conflict between the parent faith and the revolutionary movement that arose out of it. Christianity came to reshape, if not revolutionize, the covenantal bond of God to Israel, a bond that was tribal and exceptionalist in nature. A bond that was tribal and exceptionalist in nature. Solon has introduced us to Visegrad in an effort to undo the damage of supersessionism. But Visegrad Rabbi Vishagrod is doing to Christianity what Christianity did to Judaism through the through that original doctrine. Embracing Jewish election may be one way to resolve the Christian problem of responsibility for anti-Semitism. Ironically, however, the effect of this is to legitimize, indeed boost, Jewish triumphalism, separateness, and tribalism, which I have argued is a destructive force within Judaism. Ultimately, and this can already be observed in the reaction of the world to the human rights abuses of the Jewish state, this effort ultimately leads to an increase in anti-Semitism by reinforcing and lending support to Jewish exceptionalism and the behaviors that flow from that attitude and self-image. And I spoke about this myself last week's show. I remember I suggested that Zionism itself ultimately leads to anti-Semitism, or is another source of anti-Semitism. Continuing now with the book. If Christians really want to help, if they really want to undo the evils of anti-Semitism, they will do what they can to help us, to help the Jews overcome this quality rather than shoring it up. Rabbi Vishagrod's model has led us to helicopter gunships, a separation wall, the siege of Gaza, the flouting of international law, and the hatred, resentment, and mistrust of an increasingly broad sector of humankind. Reconciling with the Jewish people by reaffirming their status as God's chosen is an attempt to resolve the traumatic parting by undoing the pain of that separation. But given early Christianity's doctrine, which challenged Judaism's fundamental tribalism, and the refusal of the Jews of the time to relinquish the core beliefs as well as the ritual trappings of their tribal specialness, was this parting not inevitable? If Christians want to find a way to reconcile with Judaism and to bring the faiths closer together, then let us together look forward and find a way to join in a universal family. If, however, progressive Christians lead with an affirmation of the Jewish people's specialness, refitting aspects of Christian theology to allow for this, they end up negating the very thing that Christianity was doing, which was superseding the tribal in favor of the universal. I'm going to read that sentence again. It looks really important. If, however, progressive Christians lead with an affirmation of the Jewish people's specialness, if they lead with that affirmation, refitting aspects of Christian theology to allow for this, they end up negating the very thing that Christianity was doing, which was superseding the tribal in favor of the universal. Doing all kinds of mysterious technical stuff here. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so 6, 7, 8. Lots of viewers, or listeners, I should say. Lots of listeners online. And, of course, radio people out there. Solon's, okay, continuing here. And yet the drive to do just that appears to be quite powerful. Here's how Solon puts it in his first chapter. The question of whether Israel can see in the church a sign that is congruent with Jewish faith depends upon the church's attitude toward the Jewish people. Are the nations prepared to receive God's blessing in the context of God's covenant with Israel? Or do they seek to do away with God's beloved child in order to usurp its place in God's affection? I hope the listener out there is appreciating and comprehending what Braverman is doing in writing this book here and writing this chapter. He's very deftly touching upon every aspect. That's why that accounts for the repetitiveness of much of his points. He's constantly talking about triumphalism and tribalism, exceptionalism, and God's election of Israel as its chosen people. He's hitting upon every corner of this general philosophy in order, well, for one thing, in order to avoid being called a self-hating Jew himself for daring to challenge some of this stuff. And he's making very strong distinctions between arbitrary and even contemptuously disavowing the important aspects of these religions and making very practical examination of them and trying to make things better. Okay, let's get back to the actual text here of chapter 5. Again, by the way, the title of this chapter 5, beginning of part 2, is Undoing the Damage, Post-Holocaust Christian Theology. Continuing. Solon's question presents us with a false choice based on false premises. The problem with this kind of revisionism is that it denies the fundamentally tribal origins of Judaism and the way that the exclusivist character of the faith has survived. It is a character reinforced over two millennia, some 2,000 years, of persecution that is firmly grounded in our history, our theology, and, as Visegrad correctly points out, in our identity. Christianity had it right. Judaism was tribal and exclusivist. In the Old Testament narrative, God did elect the seed of Abraham as a special people and assigned this group a special role in history. Christianity came to recast the Old Testament narrative in the light of an emerging Christian theology, a theology that radically transformed the nature of the relationship between God and humankind from the tribal and exclusive to the universal. Christianity was not built upon Judaism in a developmental fashion. Rather, it arose out of Judaism in a transformative revolutionary process. He's really hitting it on the head, doesn't he? He wants you to understand every aspect of his philosophy, which is kudos for him. Continuing now. What Solon is proposing is a deeply conservative model. This model preserves the most archaic elements of Judaism. It is in direct conflict with the direction of Jesus' message and Paul's subsequent project to expand beyond the tribal boundaries and the cultic and legalistic strictures that came with and served to preserve and strengthen those boundaries. Far from having been the basis of a relationship with Christianity, these very qualities of Judaism were the breakpoints. If the parting was drastic, if it was, in Solon's... Start again. If the parting was drastic, if it was in Solon's description traumatic, then so be it. Crises are necessary for human development, for great things to happen in human history. Wow. We must consider how the effort to reformulate Christian theology to incorporate the original Abrahamic covenant in effect negates the revolutionary nature of Jesus' message. Jesus came to challenge the power of empire, the triumphalism of temporal rule, and to replace it with the triumph of the Spirit. Christianity made a tragic wrong turn in the view of many when it threw in with Rome in the 4th century, a mistake that it continues to seek to correct as we leave the 20th century behind, from the 4th to the 20th century. The Jewish people now face a similar choice as we confront the grim consequences of our own empowerment. In the light of current events, one must wonder if the unintended consequence of this effort at correction and atonement works not toward the expansion of Christianity, but rather its contradiction. while honoring the impulse to atone for its own historical sins, Christianity must take exceptional care not to enable the current sins of its parents. Okay. End of that subsection of the chapter. And it is 12 o'clock noon. It's 12 noon Pacific time here on the central left coast of California. We're in Santa Cruz County here. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, an unlicensed, ongoing expression of media civil disobedience in throwing off the bonds of governmental and corporate censorship and editorial constrictors. This is Free Radio, folks, a pirate radio service, 21 and a half years in the ongoing making and expression of liberating the airwaves. I feel like I'm sounding like Braverman in the way I'm constructing my sentences here. I'm not going to give out the phone number because the phone doesn't seem to be working. I'm getting no dial tone. Yes, the ringer is on, but that does not make a difference. I just found out why the phone was not working. Somebody left the damn Gentner control on. Okay, that means I have to give out the phone number. This is a live show on September 3, 2016. I just said like it's a minute and a half after 12 noon Pacific Daylight Time. Phone number here in Santa Cruz County, California, U.S. of A, 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. Feel free to call me at any point. Do not worry about interrupting. I will not put you on the air immediately. That's I've gone back and forth in this matter as to whether or not to just put you on the air right away. I've decided, again, at this point, to take your call first and then get your permission to go on the air. So call me at 831-427-3772. And again, this phone number and other contact information is available on our webpage, freakradio.org, contact link at freeradio.org. Freak Radio. The website is FREAK, freakradio.org, freakradio.org. And let's have some more music here. A little bit of Stuart Davis. When I opened the show, you were hearing a bunch of, I think it was Persian or Iranian traditional folk music, and then I played Stu Davis from his 1994 Panacea record, Self-Untitled, Pipe Bomb Guru. I opened the show with the folk music and then Pipe Bomb Guru. Here is track one from Self-Untitled, Only Changing Drugs.
I had my stomach pumped 2 times my senior year, which earned the approbation of all my plastered peers. Now I do my weekly bleeding at 28.
Try it again.
I had my stomach pumped 2 times my senior year, which earned the approbation
of
all my plastered peers. Now I do my weekly bleeding at 28.
Synced up, queued up just right, and it doesn't go off the way you want it to. What a world. Well, let's try this one here. I know I've got the volume up, and I played from it at the beginning of the show. Let's try it again. No, it's not playing. What do all these bright, fancy lights mean anyway? Oh, this is terrible. Let me try something here. No, that does not work. Dennis, Arduck, somebody, the CD player isn't working. Okay. Well, that might mean, folks, that might mean no music for the rest of the program. lubricating my larynx here. Oh, this is embarrassing. This is just, oh, what an awful world. That's really strange. I didn't change anything either. I didn't change one thing, and it just blew out. Okay, well, the rest of the day, as far as I know, is pretty much simply reruns and importations of other programs. So any music that's coming your way will come by virtue of the fact that it's a rerun, non-live programming after this program is up in about an hour.
Man in my one silver stallion, I just got my first medallion. I hire at the baseball park.
Well, back to the book then. Fatal Embrace, Christian Jews and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land by Mark Braverman. Okay. Here we go again. We're in chapter 5. James Carroll, Healing the Rift. Back in the saddle. A quotation here from James Carroll, whoever he is. 2001. The Pope's unprecedented presence in Jerusalem has said, in effect, that the Catholic Church honors Jews at home in Israel. The Pope's religious devotion at the Western Wall was an unmistakable act of affirmation of the temple and of God's unbroken covenant with the Jewish people today. Unquote. These are not the words of a fundamentalist Israeli settler or a Christian Zionist, but of a liberal Catholic theologian. James Carroll, in Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, picks up the work of Christian atonement for anti-Semitism, where some progressive Christian theologians leave off. Carroll borrows Catholic theologian Rosemary Reuther's term, the left hand of Christology, to describe how even the seemingly positive framing of the New Testament, quote, fulfillment of the Old Testament is an implicit and powerful degradation of the earlier faith and its scriptures. Christianity, he points out, established itself not as an outgrowth or continuation of Judaism, but in opposition to Judaism. Judaism, in fact, quote, was the shadow against which Christianity could be the light, unquote. He maintains that the negative picture of the Judaism of Jesus' time was a distortion of the true nature of Judaism. A Judaism with which Jesus was in more harmony than the New Testament writers depicted. Carroll argues, unconvincingly in my view, the author's view, that my throat is having a fit here. I'm sorry. I'm tense and full of anxiety. Anxiety for the sins of the world. Let me start again at some point. Carroll argues, unconvincingly in my view, that Jesus' presence in Jerusalem, as recounted in the Gospels, was evidence of his feeling of attachment to the temple and the sacrificial cult. In Carroll's work, we see an attitude to reconcile with the Jews for anti-Semitism of the Gospels and the millennia of persecution by washing out the rebellious, iconoclastic, intensely anti-cultic and anti-materialistic nature of Jesus' message. So Jesus was a rebel, an iconoclastic rebel, intensely anti-cultic and anti-materialistic. Okay. The history of the early church and its relationship to Judaism and the Jewish communities of the time is just that, history. Carroll's argument is based on a post facto analysis of documents that were the products of those times and bear only indirectly on the nature of the Judaism and Jewish establishment that Jesus himself was confronting and to which he was speaking. What is more important, Carroll's solution to the problems caused by early Christianity's anti-Jewish polemic distorts the discussion of crucial political, religious, and sociological issues that bear directly on the current situation in the Middle East. Carroll wants to tie Jesus back to the temple and, by extension, to the land. Jesus was indeed Jewish, intensely so. But is it not so that at the core of Jesus' Jewishness was his prophetic voice, a voice that in true prophetic idiom cried out against the spiritual materialism of the day? Was not Jesus expressing, in Walter Brueggemann's terms, opposition to the royal consciousness that dominated the Jewish political and priestly establishment of his time? Was not Jesus' prophetic voice raised in fierce opposition to the tribal framework of the Jewish establishment and its theology linked to the temple and the land? Having said this, might we not go on to say that what Jesus did leave behind was potentially such a fundamental challenge to the Judaism of his day that what then grew from his teachings was something that ultimately would no longer be called Jewish? Would not the, quote, trauma of separation then have been necessary? And if so, what is this drive to undo this separation, to somehow reattach Christianity to the very aspects of his Christian roots that are the most non-Christian? Because this is precisely what Carroll has set out to do. Reestablish the land as the center of Jewish spiritual life, and to then ask Christians to embrace this through their reimaging of Jesus himself. Carroll argues for this in an astonishing set of statements. Quote, Christians take the ongoing Jewish attachment to the ideal of the temple as a kind of idolatry, and by extension, many Christians take modern Israeli attachment to the land around the temple as rank imperialism, close quote. This is a mistake, submits Carroll, just as it was wrong and ultimately disastrous for Christian belief to have driven a wedge between Jesus and the temple and to purge from the faith any attachment to a physical place as the focus for worship. This is a misunderstanding of Jesus, he claims, and ultimately of the Jewish experience. Rather, and quoting here, the temple continues even now, if only the idea of it as the solitary site of Jewish worship. The Jewish hope is rooted not in a mythic never-never land, but in a place on earth. Its specificity is the point. The temple, and by extension to the land, emphasizing here, are tied to the unbreakable covenant God has made with his people. And by extension to the land. Actually, the author italicized that phrase. In other words, Carroll argues, in order to neutralize the supersessionist dogma that is the source of the Jews' suffering, we must undo that poisonous falsehood and reaffirm God's covenant with the Jewish people and with it the land promise. We can frame this reasoning in this way, and then he puts this entire sentence in two sentences in italics. You killed our Lord. In return, we killed you. Three sentences. That was wrong, and to compensate for millennia of our murderousness, you can have the temple back. For my own sake, I'm going to reread from the middle of that paragraph. In other words, wait a minute. The temple continues even now, if only the idea of it is the solitary site of Jewish worship. The Jewish hope is rooted not in a mythic never-never land, but in a place on earth. Its specificity is the point. The temple, and by extension the land, are tied to the unbreakable covenant God has made with his people. Close quote. In other words, Carroll argues, in order to neutralize the supersessionist dogma that is the source of the Jews' suffering, we must undo that poisonous falsehood and reaffirm God's covenant with the Jewish people, and with it, the land promise. We could frame this reasoning in this way. You killed our Lord. In return, we killed you. That was wrong, and to compensate for millennia of our murderousness, you can have the temple back. And just another two pages of this chapter here. And just so you know, it's 12:17 in the afternoon, Pacific time. Let Jesus be Jesus. In Carroll's telling, Christianity rose out of Judaism in one continuous developmental process. There was no discontinuity, no break, no parting. For Jesus, he submits, there was only one covenant, which was one suffused with love. It was a relationship that, if not unconditional and not without its vicissitudes, was enduring and endures still. Carroll points out that the phrase New Covenant, as it came to be used by Christianity to define its status as superseding Judaism, was first used by Jeremiah, the phrase New Covenant. He submits that Jeremiah's message in that passage was one of renewal and love, like Jesus's. But what is missing here, again, is the difference in context between the message of the Old Testament prophets and that of Jesus. What is missing is a recognition of what was new in Christianity. Jeremiah, whatever he meant by the image of a new covenant, was operating within the framework of God's relationship with the people of Israel. The prophet's grief at Israel's transgressions and its exhortations to return to the ways of the Lord are expressed in the context of God's grief at his people's betrayal. In other words, it is particularistic. Jeremiah's grief is expressed completely in the context of the Old Testament narrative and worldview. In contrast, what Jesus was talking about was a radical shift to a universal covenant, one that would be available to all of humankind, all of God's children. Yes, the prophets talk about love, but love of whom? Carroll wants us to believe that Jesus took his message to Jerusalem and not, as in the New Testament telling, against Jerusalem. Again, he is protesting against the anti-Semitism in the Christian narrative. That anti-Semitism is painfully apparent. But why should we reinvent Jesus in order to make up for this? As if we could undo that evil by recasting what is core in Jesus' message, which is that he was bringing something new. It was something so new, in fact, such a departure from the tribal separatist nature of the Israel that he knew, that ultimately there was no turning back from a break with those Jews who would not relinquish that same quality of their peoplehood and their relationship with God. To Carroll, therefore, and to those Christians who are, in good faith, attempting to heal the wound and to reconcile with the Jewish people, I put it to you this way. Say you're sorry. Affirm your sense of connection, even continuity, with the Jewish sources of your tradition and your history. Study and honor the treasure and majesty of the Hebrew Scriptures, but let Jesus be Jesus, and be willing to leave the original covenant behind! And be willing to leave the original covenant behind. Let Jesus be Jesus. The path to reconciliation and coexistence with the Jewish people is not through embracing what was and continues to be most problematic about our tradition. For there is a problem with this. For there is a problem with the movement among progressive Christians to reestablish a connection with the Old Testament and to affirm its validity as a sacred body of work on its own merits, rather than as a proof text rather than as a proof text for Jesus' divinity. The problem is that, absent an honest confrontation with these aspects of the Old Testament theology and worldview, this effort brings with it an acceptance and ultimately a legitimization of God's exclusivist tribal covenant with the Jews. And it is this implicit legitimization that is most dangerous in the current context of the behavior of the state of Israel. Ironically, this effort on the part of Christians sets out the parameters of the current urgent crisis for the Jewish people. We have long struggled with the tension between the universalism inherent in our monotheistic creed and ethical code and the particularism so deeply embedded in our own identity and historical experience that at no time more so than today. And, of course, the author, as a Jew himself, is talking about the Jews. Okay, folks, here's the final paragraph of this chapter. The implications of this reworking of Christian doctrine with respect to the Jewish people are profound. As Paul Van Buren himself points out, the powerful spectacle of a triumphant state of Israel lent force and validation to the Jewish triumphalism articulated in the new theology. In the political as well as interfaith arenas, the stage was set to make common cause with those within the Jewish community seeking to establish a theological and historical basis for the modern-day Jewish nationalist project. Referring in general to Zionism. I added that explanation there. Okay. Okay, he's right. See, as I was saying closer to the beginning of this recording, this program, he really gets into it, and a lot of repetition here, which was a major complaint I had with the author of Solving 9/11, which I read, a year or so ago. It's author Christopher Bolin, a very learned man who's very courageous in putting out his evidence and his propositions in that book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. Yet, unfortunately, Bolin is simply not a very good writer. He's entirely too repetitive, doesn't know how to be as concise as he could have been in writing that book. I keep wondering under how much or what kind of pressure Bolin may have been to rewrite Solving 9/11. At any rate, I think this particular author, Mark Braverman, does know how to write, certainly compared to Mr. Bolin. But he still does a lot of repeating, as if to tie all the loose ends of everything together and to hit us on the head with it. That may or may not be a bad thing, but it is the kind of stuff that makes one want to turn off this program. Hopefully pick up the book Fatal Embrace and read it themselves for future self-enhancement and understanding. Okay. I wish I could get this darn thing to play some music here. The green light is blinking. C1. I don't get it. I don't know what I did wrong. It's cranking away there, but
there was a star that was hidden in space, an undiscovered gem.
Dennison decided they had chosen to tag on the kid. Okay, well, thinking if there's... Boy, that really punches a hole in the program, doesn't it? When I cannot provide a so-necessary musical break. When we moved from the old studio to the new one here, we severely cut down on our record collection, our vinyl, our LPs, and I personally was one of the people who went through them and decided what we should keep and what we wouldn't keep. The other guys in the radio collective probably wondered why I kept a lot of the ones that I did. And I kept thinking, I think we need this one for the potential sound effects and this one for the potential sound effects if we were to get into some real original studio production of brand new programming. Let me look for records here. Before at least some tape. It's too difficult for one person to do. There's too much,
not enough light. You need someone to hold up the curtains so the ambient light comes in there. I'm telling you, folks, this is a walk-in closet, small walk-in closet-sized studio. So, and the real drag of it is, for me, there's no musical opportunity for me to eat my burrito, which has been getting cold all this time. I want to provide you with some audio entertainment here, so I think what I'll do is, let's see, weekly shows. Here, let me put this up. Good old standby here. Which means I'll have to... Okay, we're all okay. Okay, folks, relax. Here's something to listen to other than my voice.
Riz Orchestra Revolution Radio.
Why is...
Presenting... Symphony on the Corner.
That volume level was true.
Music
up entirely
for imaginary
too high.
Orchestra.
Okay. Studio, now you're starting to scare me. I can't even... Thank you.
Had my stomach pumped two times my senior year, which earned the approbation of all my plastered peers. Now I do my weekly bleeding at trendy AA meetings. I was a social monster, but now I serve my sponsor. I choke out cliche confessions. I suck down coffee black and I chain smoke cigarettes in between handfuls. Prozac man in my one sober stallion. I just got my first medallion. My higher power drug me. I'm letting strangers hug me. And now I really crave a meeting. All those soothing empty greetings. The big book is omniscient, and I'm not self-sufficient. Dependency still coursing through my blood. I'm only changing drugs. Step program, which hollow slogan was it? We found serenity, and day by day or easy does it. Plant that affirmation seed. Our license plate should read 10,000 lakes and treatment centers, ready for to statewide mentor. They say the devil's in the details of this cunning, baffling habit. I poured out all my NyQuil. I flushed my sonic tablets. Don't there's inventory. Thanks for sharing your sick story. My bluff, I know they'll call it. I'm Stuart, I'm an alcoholic. Dysfunction breeds a strange ascension. Quoting pointless daily phrases. The big book is our mission, and I'm not self-sufficient. Dependency still coursing through my blood. I'm only changing drugs.
Such a wreck. I spent endless evenings with my face draped against your neck. It hurt when I was empty and friends just turned away. It was you who chose to stay and helped me heal, eased me back into a hole. Now it's you who is aching and needs to be consoled. Can't you see I'm happy now? I don't want to sit and watch you cry. I wish you'd keep it all inside. Yes, you're in anguish. Do you think that you're the first? Since when am I indentured to be your private nurse? Maybe this callousness is a form of love that I extend. Cause I know if you face the hurt alone, you'll be stronger in the end. So don't play off my conscience like I should wipe away your tears. Just let your burdens fall on someone else's ears. I don't know how long I can sit with you this time. Cause the suffering in your life shrouds the joy in mine. So maybe you should just call me when the sadness finally ends and you're ready to laugh again. Spare me the drama. Such a wreck. I spent endless evenings with my face draped against your neck.
Thank you, Stuart. And whoops. And thank me for having the bravery for continuing to experiment with things. Turns out there was a dial that I had turned up earlier. I misunderstood its purpose, which is very strange considering I've used it pretty consistently for 4 years, and I was thinking, I was in a frame of mind where I was thinking it was auxiliary. I didn't need to use it. But the really great news is there's nothing wrong with the CD player. I mean, I take it you all heard that music. That last item, last two items actually, were Stuart Davis, who hails from Minnesota, although he'll tell you he was conceived behind a warehouse in Iowa. Stu Davis, Someone Else's Ears. That was preceded by Only Changing Drugs. Now, there's some stuff that we can relate to, right? Someone Else's Ears, Only Changing Drugs. And he's so articulate and intelligent, and he knows how to use a thesaurus, which he also brags about. yeah, that's refreshing, not only because it's musical, but we know what he's talking about. I began the musical break here with Symphony on the Corner, which is actually a half-hour program that we run on Monday afternoons here every week. Symphony on the first installment of Symphony on the Corner. Although, admittedly, all the 10 or so items in that folder all sound pretty much the same to my ear anyway. Okay. Oh, goodness. It's a quarter to one. You're here for a reading. We're going to change chapters here. Hopefully, we'll switch gears in terms of Mark Braverman's approach to the Middle Eastern conflict and the underpinnings of it and how to fix it. Okay, reading from the 2010 book Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. The author is Jewish himself. Chapter 6, Theological Urgency and the Promise of the Land. He opens with another quotation from James Carroll, this from the aforementioned Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews. That it took the Holocaust to open an honorable and reciprocal dialogue between Jews and Christians is an outrage. I'll read that again here in case you weren't ready to get into this. That it took the Holocaust an open and honorable reciprocal dialogue between Jews and Christians is an outrage. But that the Holocaust requires us, personally as well as institutionally, to understand how such events were prepared for by other events is an absolute moral legacy. The question posed itself not to me but to history. How did the cross of Jesus Christ become the cross at Auschwitz? James Carroll. Chapter 6. I paid a visit to a professor of theology at the seminary of a major Protestant denomination. He is the author of articles and books in the post-supersessionist tradition in which he takes on the blatantly anti-Semitic aspects of Christian doctrine, as well as strongly reaffirming the special relationship between God and the Jewish people. I told him that I felt we had a lot in common, that as a Jew I was committed, as he was as a Christian, to religious reform, to rooting out those elements in my religious tradition that required correction. Drawing on my reservoir of chutzpah, I turned then to my critique of his work. Without question, I said, confronting the anti-Semitism embedded in supersessionism was a good thing. But had early Christianity's bold challenge to some of Judaism's central tenets really been such a misguided project? I told him that I thought that the very elements of Judaism in most urgent need of reform were precisely those that the early church had addressed. I made it clear that my ideas arose out of my great distress about the negative outcomes of political Zionism and my sense that something deeply embedded in Judaism itself was at work in the abusive practices of the Jewish state. My concern was that in the rush to atone for anti-Semitism... Well, I'd better answer the phone here. I'm sure you all heard that loud. Free radio. Stand by, folks. Okay, I'm going to have to interrupt you because I am in the middle of doing show, and I'm the only one here. Is there someone in particular you're trying to get a hold of? Were you told that your program is going to be archived? By whom? And you, Paul Rubin, is that right? Okay, what I'm going to do is take your number, and I'll contact Nancy myself and have her talk to you. That's all I can do, really. Wait a minute, my pen. Yes, folks, we're taking care of some business here. This is how we do things at Free Radio Santa Cruz, because we don't have secretaries and pretty much do not have the kind of help that we can use in getting stuff done here. So stand by again. Oh, and my pen. The only pen in the house is Boken. Oh, Boken. Wait a minute. God, what a drag. Disabled Veterans National Foundation, it says here. Okay. Paul, R-U-B-E-N, 2-L. What's the other fellow's name? I'm sorry, H-U-D-O-K-K. And you want to find out about... You were told that your program was going to be archived? Okay, so I'll have Nancy. Can I have your... And let me put this... Ooh, my gut here, so no one else here. Hang in there, folks. Here's me, zero. Good. My program? I'm Ren. I do the mid... Yeah, really. Okay, I'll take that. Okay, thank you, Paul. And that, dear listener, is the short version of having to put you, my dear listeners, on hold. It's, I took 2 or 3 minutes out so I could take care of business, as it were. Well, this is indeed is another very choppy show, I feel it's been. I hope you've gotten something out of it. It's 12:53,
And I never know if the next guy is going to come in and do his show or not. Nancy, if you're listening, our DJ Nancy, who called me a week or two ago, that was Paul Rubin on the line, and he wonders where his show is archived. I mean, I could, if you did indeed archive it, most likely it was at radioforall.net where my stuff is archived. But he checked the archives from our website, which is kind of, my understanding is that Freak Radio's archives are kind of defunct now or unusable or unapproachable or something. So that's where he checked. That's where Paul Rubin checked. Paul's the guy who played with Joey on a recent show of yours, I guess. So you're going to need to get in touch with him. I will call you because I have his number, which I will not give out on the radio. Thank you, Nancy, and I'll be in touch with you again before too long, probably this afternoon. It's, yes, indeedy, a choppy show. I just began the chapter. It'd be nice if I could at least get 6 minutes until one here. Yeah, let me finish this up here. Let's get close to finishing up the section anyway. My concern was that in the rush to atone for anti-Semitism, progressive Christian theology was indirectly and often quite directly permitting and even validating these practices by a step. And let me start at a sentence earlier. I made it clear that my idea arose out of my great distress about the negative outcomes of political Zionism and my sense that something deeply embedded in Judaism itself was at work in the abusive practices of the Jewish state. My concern was that in the rush to atone for anti-Semitism, progressive Christian theology was indirectly and often quite directly permitting and even validating these practices by establishing God's covenant with the Jewish people as fundamental and primary. I expressed to him my concern about the political implications of this stream in progressive Christian thought and my concerns that it legitimated Israel's land grabs, suppressed criticism of Israel's human rights violations, and thwarted honest, productive interfaith dialogue about the Israel-Palestine situation. The professor's response was swift. "That's an old story," he said to me. "It's the story of an archaic tribal Judaism and an enlightened universalist Christianity. We don't tell that story anymore," unquote. He stated that even if this old story had not been discredited by virtue of its blatant anti-Semitism and its responsibility for millennia of persecution of the Jews, it was passé, having been demonstrated to be theologically unsound. The Protestant pastor he was talking to said that. I was stunned by his reaction. Yes, this may have been an old story. Much of late 20th century Christian theology is devoted to correcting this theory, as in the words of James D.G. Dunn, quote, "a parody of both Second Temple Judaism and Paul's debt to his Jewish heritage," 2003. This simplistic and biased, quote, "black and white" picture fully deserved to be discredited, especially in view of its pernicious effects throughout Christian history. But I had expected more receptivity. The professor seemed closed to a discussion about this issue. Anything, apparently, that bore even the whiff of Christian anti-Jewishness had to be summarily discounted and barred from further discussion. What was required, rather, was vigilance about the appearance of such views. Although the professor had written extensively on this precise topic, there would be no nuanced theological discussion today, because the important issue is not the theological soundness of the original discredited doctrine. That's the end of sentence. What was important was the effect the doctrine had produced throughout history. Atoning for anti-Semitism trumped all other discussions. The exchange with the professor that day is far from an isolated case. Vigilance against anti-Semitism underlies or explicitly characterizes
most interfaith discussions today. In our current political climate, it seems acceptable for Christians to look critically at those elements of their own faith and their history that have caused harm, especially when these have been cornerstones of their doctrine. But it is not permissible to extend this conversation into any criticism of Judaism or into the examination of the behavior of Jews or their institutions that might deserve scrutiny or correction. While Christian sins are fair game, criticism of Judaism or things Jewish is simply out of bounds. And it's a minute before 1 p.m. I am going to stop the show now. Incidentally, the name of the next subsection in this chapter is entitled The Christian Sin. And then A Guest in the House of Israel, Theological Urgency. It's time to give you, whet your appetite for next Saturday. The Christianization of Judaism, Election as Grace. I never understood the word grace. Maybe I'll be helped out in that department next week. Validating the Election of the Jewish People. Okay, so this is Chapter 6 of Fatal Embrace by Mark Braverman. We'll continue next Saturday with, but I'm sure it will be an utterly flawless program from a technical point of view. I hope. It's 1 o'clock until next Saturday at 11 a.m., as every Saturday, 11 a.m., weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, 11 a.m. Pacific Time. Not to forget Monday afternoons at 1500 hours Pacific. That's 3 p.m. for the other edition of Mideast Migraines. You take care. Do what you can, but behave yourself. Bye for now. God. I'm going to close out with my headphones here. Bye for now.